I'm so pleased that we get to jump into this next installment of our fall series called Epic. And for those of you who are newer with us at Ada Bible Church, my name is Jeff, and I get to serve as a teaching pastor here at the church. And I have the privilege of carrying us through the end of the series. I get to take the last three parts in December. And so let's begin today by talking about teacups. Old school teacups with matching saucers. My mother had these. She had them arrayed in our living room on what I would just call a knick-knack shelf. That's not the picture of our home, but that just kind of gives you the idea of the thing. And I think many of these teacups and saucers she had received as gifts. My mom was a pastor's wife, and in a previous church that my dad was a pastor at, I think it was either her birthday or maybe a going-away gift when they moved on to a different ministry, but the women in the church, most of them older women, got together and each got her a unique teacup and matching saucer, and so some of these women had passed away, and so this was her way of remembering some of those women, and it wasn't a huge financial I don't think they were valuable financially, but they were valuable emotionally, and they carried great sentimental value to her. I was playing basketball in the living room. Yeah. I must have been 11, maybe 12, maybe just thinking, throwing it up and trying to spin it on my finger. Basketball lands on the corner of this knick-knack shelf, slams into it, the whole thing comes down, crashes on the floor. You're thinking, Jeff, your mom must have been furious. No, it was worse. She was sad. And I have this distinct childhood memory of my mom sitting on the floor, sifting through the broken pieces, seeing what was retrievable. Could this handle be attached again with some super glue? Can this chip be glued back into place? And I am not sure there was a matching set that survived with an intact cup and an intact saucer. A distinct childhood memory I have is my mom sitting there among the broken pieces. And as we talk about our character Daniel today, I just want that image kind of be galvanized in your mind. Because we're going to be looking in on a people who are sitting surrounded by broken pieces and broken parts. Our character today is Daniel, and it's important for me not just for you to know who Daniel is, but for you to know when Daniel is. You see, through this epic series, it's been our goal not simply to bring you stories from the Bible, but to help you get a sense of the story of the Bible. And this is why from week to week we've shown this timetable here. It began with the patriarchs. God comes to a man by the name of Abraham and says, Abraham, I need you to move. You should have moved to a place you've never been before, and I will bless you, and I will bless your descendants, and I want to bless the whole world through you and your offspring. The idea here at the very beginning of our Bible is that God desires to create a community with himself at the center. And the offspring of Abraham, they find themselves enslaved in Egypt, and then we come to the Exodus under the leadership of Moses. The people exit captivity in Egypt, and they go out into the desert where they receive the covenant, where God says, I will be your God, and you will be my people. And people in the neighboring countries, they're going to find out about me by watching us and how we relate. Then comes the kingdom, the first three kings, Saul, David, and Solomon. And Solomon builds this temple to Yahweh, the God of Israel. And the idea is, again, that people would stream into Israel and they would learn about this God of creation by watching his relationship with his people, and things unravel really fast. They stray so far from the design that God had for them. And the prophets come and the prophets warn and they say, we need to turn, we need to turn, or God will withhold his blessing from us. Do not think that he is obligated to continue to bless us as we defy him. And the people don't turn, and destruction comes. Destruction comes in the form of the Babylonian army, and it is 605 BC. Just on a map here, Babylon is way over to the right, Jerusalem in the middle there, and Egypt to the left. The Assyrian Empire is folding, it's disintegrating, and now two other superpowers are duking it out to find out who's going to be number one, and Babylon goes to war against Egypt. Well, you note that Jerusalem is in between those two superpowers. And the Babylonians annihilate the Egyptians and Israel. They had sided with the Egyptians. So on the way back home, Nebuchadnezzar stops at Jerusalem and besieges the city in order to starve it out. 605 BC, 600 years before the time of Jesus. This, my friends, is where the book of Daniel begins. Opening words. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and he besieged it. You besiege a city by surrounding it so that no food can get in or out and no people can get in or out. It's to starve out the city, and they tap out. They go, we give. Well, then what happens next? The Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, Nebuchadnezzar's hand. Check this out. Along with some of the articles from the temple of God. What's going on with that? Bowls, utensils, cups from the temple that King Solomon built. Nebuchadnezzar confiscates those. And this is what he does with them. Check it out. These he carried off to to the temple of his God in Babylon and put in the treasure house of his God. Now, it's a different land, it's a different custom, it's a different culture, it's a different age, but wars were seen as theological. It wasn't just our army beat your army, it's our God beat your God. When Nebuchadnezzar takes the cups and bowls and utensils from the temple in Jerusalem, hauls them 1,000 miles away to the temple of his God in Babylon, he's basically saying, your God is weak. Your God is pathetic. Your God is helpless to help you. Listen, if I'm living in the days of Daniel, sitting among the broken pieces, I'm just going like, there's some questions that surface. Is God like done with us? And how could this, the name and honor of God possibly be elevated in the middle of this wreckage? And how could God possibly be at work amidst the broken pieces? And it was going to get, my friends, it was going to get worse. Some 18 years later, Nebuchadnezzar would return, annihilate the city of Jerusalem, burn it to the ground, destroy the temple of Solomon, and haul most of the population away, 1,000 miles away, to Babylon. Deport the population. I'm telling you, man, if you're living in those days, you're just kind of wondering, how could God possibly be at work in these broken pieces? I got a question. You ever break anything? I'm not talking about dishes. Or maybe it wasn't you that did the breaking. Maybe something happened to you. Or maybe something was done to you. But there you sit, like my mom with the shattered cups and saucers, you sit around the broken pieces and you wonder, is God done with me? And how could he possibly be at work in the midst of these broken pieces? Today we're going to explore two different episodes, multiple episodes in the life and ministry of Daniel. We're going to pick two of them. One from chapter 1, one from chapter 6. One when he is very young, I think he's a teenager. And one, when he is old, I think he's in his 80s. I think as we explore these two episodes, I think that we will have hopefully some guidance and some hope in God being at work in those seasons when we find ourselves surrounded by broken pieces and broken parts. Episode number one, just call them the King's Table. The King's Table. And I just want to pick up there in verse 3 of Daniel chapter 1. Understand, this is like right out of the gate in the book of Daniel in your Old Testament. It says that the king ordered Ashpenaz, wonderful name. Those of you expecting and looking for unique baby names, there are some will appear in our passage today. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of the court officers, to bring in to the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal families and from the nobility. Nebuchadnezzar, his empire is so vast, he's on a talent search to pillage every country he conquers to bring the best and the brightest to Babylon to serve in his Babylonian government. When it says that these guys that he gets, I think they're teenagers, Israelites from the royal families and the nobility, I think that they were already being trained for future positions in Israel. They had little knowledge, and their parents had little knowledge, that they were actually being brought up and trained for future positions in Babylon. It says, how do you qualify for the program? Well, here you go. Young man, without any physical defect, handsome, really, that was one of the qualifications. You had to be good looking. Showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. Now, the king, that's Nebuchadnezzar, assigned them a daily amount of food and wine at the king's table. They were to be trained for how long? For 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. Crash course. You got to go to language school. First of all, you got to qualify. You have poise, appearance, bearing, gravity to be able to be a court worker. I was thinking about it in these terms. If we're talking about in our culture today, if these guys from Israel are picked to come on up, and if they were at a fancy meal, they already knew which fork to use. Poise. Now they got to go to language school. The literature of the Babylonians, the customs, the legends, the mythology. What's going on here is a total attempt to make them Babylonian. Total indoctrination. Total retraining. Total rewiring. And we get the names of four of the guys. You're probably familiar with one of them right out of the gate. His name is Daniel. The other three guys were looking at Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. It's like, yeah, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. I'm not sure I'm familiar with those. Okay. By the way, each of those four names, they had the name of God embedded in their name, the God of Israel. So just looking at it this way, Elohim was one of the names for God. Elohim, another name, like the God of Israel, Yahweh, we say Jehovah, that Yahweh had a kind of Ayah thing going on in it. So Dan El, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, Daniel, God is my judge, Hananiah, Yahweh is gracious, Mishael, who is what God is, and Azariah, Yahweh has helped. And so it's like the name of their God was embedded within their own name as part of their person. When they get to Babylon, it's not only Babylonian literature and Babylonian customs, they get name changes. Their names are changed too. Belteshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Oh, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I remember them from Sunday school. That's Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. In the change of the names to Babylonian names, God is removed from their name. It's believed that Babylonian gods are used in some of their names. And it's like, listen, you aren't even you anymore. Total indoctrination, total rewiring in all things Babylonian. But there was something there. It's kind of a perk. I don't know if you saw it or not. I think it was in verse 5 where it said, the king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. And what this meant was, if you're Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, or Azariah, it means you are now eating like a eating like a king, which is awesome. So just an image here. I don't know what it looked like, but an image of the king's table. There we go. This is awesome. Is this going to be problematic? I mean, didn't the Jews have this kind of clean and unclean thing? Lamb, goat, okay. Pork. Not. I don't think Daniel had ever had a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich. And it's kind of like, we got a problem here. And we read these words. It says, Daniel, now, but Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. So maybe it was the king's table, Nebuchadnezzar's table, was loaded up with all the unclean foods, which, by the way, was one of the things that separated Israel from other the peoples around. You're separated even if in your diet. It may have also been that the food at Nebuchadnezzar's table was first offered to an idol, a god of Babylon, and there was a feeling that if you participated in the meal, you were honoring that same god of Babylon. But for whatever reason, Daniel believes that accepting the king's food would have been rejecting the God of Israel. It's like, yeah, bring me to Babylon, teach me literature, take me through language school, change my name, but yeah, this isn't okay. Daniel resolves not to eat from the king's table. And his buddies do the same thing. Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, they decide to do the same thing. It's like, you can take God out of our names. You have not removed him from our lives. Very powerful, very powerful. Now he's got a problem. And I just love when you get to verse 9, there's this guy that's in charge of the food. And when Daniel brings this issue to this guy, listen, man, don't get me in trouble. We've got these words. Now God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel. Check that out. Check that. It's weird. Because they're sitting with all of this brokenness. Remember, it's like, how can God possibly be at work? And the weirdness is that the camera moves from the land of Israel over here to Babylon, and God is at work in these four faithful teenagers. But God makes an appearance. God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel, but the official said to Daniel, hey, listen, I'm scared, man. I'm afraid of my Lord the King, who has assigned you food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would have my head because of you. It's okay if you want to die for your faith, but don't make me die for your faith. He's like, I didn't pick this menu. Nebuchadnezzar picked this menu. If he comes to inspect you and you look all malnourished and he figures out it's because I changed the menu, he's going to take me out. And Daniel just does something so wise here. He says, okay, I have a proposal. A 10-day test drive. Just a week and a half. Just give us a week and a half. Instead of the king's table, just give us some vegetables and water. And just check in on us after 10 days. And then do what you desire to do. Now, I don't know about you, but a week and a half doesn't seem like a long period of time to test drive a diet. It's enough time for God to work, but not enough time for this guy to lose his head. And so 10 days later, he shows up and says, man, you guys look great. In fact, you guys look better than the other guys. And he allows them to stick to this diet for 3 years. 3 years. 3 years of language school. 3 years of literature training. 3 years of the customs of Babylon in order to be part of the Babylonian government. And at the end of 3 years, they have their final exam. And their final exam, they have to stand in front of the big guy, Nebuchadnezzar, who asks some questions and who's deciding who is worthy of serving in my court. And we read these words. Again, I need you to see the involvement of God in the story. To those four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. What's happening here in this story is this. The people were sitting with all of these broken pieces, going, is God done with us? How could God possibly be at work in the middle of all this breakage and destruction. And God begins to appear in a surprising place and in a surprising way. God begins to be at work in the Babylonian court in the lives of four faithful teenagers. God is at work, God is at work, God is at work. He is at work among the broken pieces. That's episode one, the king's table. Before we jump to episode two, there's a couple things here. I just want to challenge you with a couple things. And so I just written these down here. One is Daniel's grace and one is Daniel's resolve. Daniel's grace. I just want you to notice how polite he is in the story. In fact, all of the exchange, it says he asks permission not to eat from the king's table. And then he proposes graciously this 10-day test drive. I think you would discover these three words right here with he's gracious, he's respectful, and he's polite. He's graceful, he's respectful, and he's polite. Got it? Are you sure? Okay. There's going to be a week upcoming. Maybe it was last week at, you know, Thanksgiving. When you were in a heated, animated conversation with someone who held a different opinion about vaccines, about immigration, or about gender and sexuality. Gracious, respectful, and polite. Jeff, I could never respect that opinion. No. What we're talking about here is being respectful of the person as you express your opinion. Daniel here is resisting the pull of that culture, but he's doing it in a way that is gracious, respectful, and polite. Is it just me, or could we be challenged in an area here about our tone? Daniel's grace. The second one is just Daniel's resolve. It says he resolved not to eat from the king's table. It seems that he made up his mind. He decided not to eat from the king's table. And just three words for you here, and the three words are these. Man, decide in advance. There's just some things you just need to decide in advance. A high school junior who might be college bound, taking the college route, you're doing college visits. Listen. Before you hit a university campus, before you hit a college campus, decide in advance. Decide what? Decide what your relationship with alcohol will be before you get there. No one looks back and says, you know, I remember the day I decided that alcohol would control my life. They just never decided that it wouldn't. Just decide in advance what your relationship with alcohol will be. I was thinking about this last week, and I thought, man, that is good advice for incoming college freshmen. My friends, that is good advice for someone joining a law firm. Decide in advance what your relationship with alcohol will be. Decide in advance. Daniel resolved in his heart. Some of you are working like crazy. Man, listen, God bless you. To escape financial slavery and to be able to embrace financial freedom, it's a challenging process. And in the process of pursuing financial freedom, many of you are coming in contact with the dreaded B word, budget. Oh, a budget. Listen, I've heard it said, this is all a budget is. A budget is telling your money where to go instead of wondering where it all went. Telling your money where it's going to go rather than wondering where it went. But basically, a budget, you decide in advance. You decide in advance. Daniel resolved. The word we used to use was the word dating. So I just think seeing someone, going out with someone. Listen, decide in advance. Decide in advance what character traits that person should possess that you want to join your life to. Character traits like honesty. Do they lie to you and to other people? Basic kindness. Industry. Are they allergic to work? You say, no, Jeff. Character is not important. Chemistry. Chemistry is what you're looking for. My friends, it is possible to have really good chemistry with someone who really isn't a good person. Now, what you want is both character and chemistry, but look for character first. As you get romantically involved, your ability to see who they really are tends to get clouded over time. What am I saying? Decide in advance. Decide in advance whether you are 17, 27, or 57. Decide in advance the character traits that this person should have, whether they have a spiritual pulse, at least a desire to want to love God and love others. Decide in advance, decide in advance. Daniel resolved, he made up his mind, that he would not defile himself with the king's food. This was not the last time he would have to cling to this kind of resolve. And as we turn to the next episode, he is no longer young, he is old. I think he's in his 80s. And this time, his resolve will put his life at risk. Episode number two, we just say the open window. Episode number two, the open window. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. You're thinking, Jeff, the scope of the Babylonian Empire, I mean, that's massive. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, Jeff, today that would encompass part of the countries of Iraq, Iran, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, and parts of Turkey. That's what you're thinking. And you're thinking, and they didn't have email. They could only send a message at the speed of a galloping horse. How in the world are you going to govern an empire that vast? I know what they're going to need. You know what they're going to need? They're going to need some satraps. They're going to need 120 satraps. What's a satrap? It's like a governor of a geographic area. The king now, Babylon, is turned over. The Babylonian Empire lasted like 70 years. Now the Persians rolled in. Daniel's going to lose his job. No, he now has a position in the Persian Empire. You're thinking, my goodness, that's a lot of direct reports to the king, Darius. No. He's got three administrators. He's saying, wonderful. Thank you so much, Jeff. This is very helpful. This is why I decided to drive to church today to learn about Persian infrastructure in the 6th century BC. No, listen. This is exactly where chapter 6 begins, where we read the words, it pleased Darius, that's the king of the Persian Empire, to appoint how many? 120 satraps to rule throughout his kingdom with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. Daniel's got one of the top spots that oversee all of those governor satrap people. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king would not suffer loss. An empire that big and that vast, lots of money could disappear. Kickbacks, bribes, embezzling. And then the rumor begins to float through the administration that the king, Darius, is picking Daniel for the number one spot to oversee the whole thing. Ah, now we have the makings for political jealousy, political rivalry. And the question they're asking is, how do we get this guy out of the way? How do we get him discredited? How do we get him removed? And maybe, how do we get him dead? So they start to dig for the dirt. Go through all of the old financials. Where was government money used for personal reasons? Happens all the time. Let's dig through and let's find it. Let's talk to old disgruntled employees and find out what inappropriate activities took place that didn't quite make the official record. And they dig for the dirt, and they dig for the dirt, and they dig for the dirt, and they find nothing. This is the way it's presented to us. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor what? What's the last word? Neither corrupt nor negligent. Neither corrupt, meaning no bribes, no kickbacks, no embezzling. But there are some people that don't take bribes and they don't embezzle money, but they don't do much of anything. It says, nor negligent. The guy was in a habit of getting up and going to work and serving well and doing his job. He was neither corrupt nor negligent. Powerful. And they go, listen, how are we going to pin something on this guy? And they can't find any dirt. So they say, okay, I think we can take that one thing that he does. What one thing? Oh, the open window. See, three times a day, Daniel up the stairs to the window on his knees, praying to the God of Israel. Three times a day. Was this as the sun was rising in the morning, up the stairs to the window on his knees? Was this the midday heat, up the window, up the stairs to the window on his knees? Was this as the sun was setting and the day is coming to a close, up the stairs to the window on his knees, day after day after day after day, three times a day, up the stairs to the window on his knees? They say, maybe we can use that to get him. And so they, as a group, they come to the king, Darius. Oh, majestic king, oh, wonderfulness. They appeal to his ego. Because thou art so grand and so great, just please sign a law that cannot be repealed, that over 30 days, no one can offer a prayer to anyone except you. And if someone offers a prayer to any god or person other than to you, that person should be thrown to the lions, literally tossed into a den of lions and torn to death by lion's teeth and lion's claws. Okay, sign here. Sign here. Now, I got some advice for Daniel. Find a closet. A closet with no windows to pray in. That's my advice to Daniel. Or, dude, just sit there in your chair and pray in your heart. That's legal, right? Daniel's in his 80s. What's he gonna do? Look at this resolve. I think we find it in verse 10. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows open toward Jerusalem. Three times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to God just as he had done before. He hears about the decree and still up the stairs to the window on his knees. And as he's praying now, there is a gallery below. I mean, there's some people in the city below looking up at that window. We see them in the next verse. It says, then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. And they go, gotcha. Gotcha. What's he doing? Well, he was very devoted to his quiet time. I think there's something else going on here. What prayer could be so important and so consuming that he's risking his life to go up the stairs to the window on his knees after he knows that he's putting his life at risk? What in the world is he doing there? I think we get a couple clues. Did you see what direction the windows were facing? Did anyone see that? And the gallery watching from down below, what do they see Daniel doing? And these are two of the clues. It says the windows open toward what? He's facing west, toward Jerusalem, and they see him asking God for help, just as he had done before. What is Daniel doing praying toward Jerusalem and asking God for help with what? And I think we find the answer 400 years earlier, where Solomon, son of King David, builds this temple to the God of Israel. And he builds this temple, and at the dedication ceremony of the temple, King Solomon, son of King David, offers this prayer where he says, God, if we ever blow it so bad that we end up in other countries, in captivity again, please, when we face this place and this city and this temple, please hear our prayer and forgive us. I want you to see a fraction of King Solomon's prayer. This is what he prayed. And if they turn back to you with all their heart and soul and pray to you toward the city you have chosen and toward the temple that I have built in your name, then from heaven, your dwelling place, hear their prayer and their plea and uphold their cause and forgive your people. This is what I think Daniel is doing as he faces Jerusalem. I think he's pleading with God for restoration. I think he's pleading for the restoration of the people. I think he's pleading for the restoration of Jerusalem, which had been burned to the ground. I think he's pleading for the restoration of the temple that had been demolished. And I think he was pleading for the reputation of the God of Israel that desired a community with himself at the center, and it had gone so badly wrong. Daniel sits among the broken pieces and prays that God will restore. Is there not something in that that touches something in you? Because you long for God to restore the hearts of your kids? Or you long for God to restore the heart of a parent? You long for God to restore laughter to friends of yours who are grieving a tragic loss? You plead for God to restore your broken heart or to restore you to the kind of person that loves and gives and serves. Listen, the heart's longing is for the broken pieces to be restored. In Daniel, we see someone who risked his life to pray for restoration. In Jesus, we meet someone who gave his life for our restoration. And through his death and resurrection, someday at the end of time, God will restore all that which is broken and lost. Which means that if he is actually the restorer of all things someday and is already at work in his restoration now, that really means that he is the best thing going on. These guys in the gallery, they run off to Darius and they go, remember that law that you passed, 30 days, no one praying anything? Yes, I certainly do, and I signed that into law. Well, there's this guy by the name of Daniel, and Darius, oh no, he loves Daniel, he values Daniel, he needs Daniel, he does everything he can to find a loophole. And then they come back at the end of the day and they said, no loophole, you need to fulfill your obligation. And so we read these words. So the king gave the order and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den, and that's how he died. 30 seconds of silence for Daniel. Actually, no, what? Some of you know what happened. Do you know what happened here? Some of you know what happened because this made the Sunday school papers. This is what happened to Daniel. The lions don't eat him. Now listen. We're familiar with the activity of the story. I need you to see the conversation in the story. Darius commands that Daniel is thrown into the den of lions. I need you to hear what he says. As the stone gets rolled over the mouth of the lion's den, I want you to hear the king of Persia who said this. The king said to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you. Your God, whose name has been trashed and diminished, and your capital leveled, may that God rescue you. Darius goes home. He can't eat, he can't sleep, no entertainment, no dancing, and no singers. And the next morning, early in the next morning, he runs back to the den of lions, calling in an anguished voice. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions? And Daniel says, I'm still here, and God has rescued me from the lions. And the people that accuse Daniel, they are then thrown into the lion's den with their families. And that part didn't make the Sunday school papers. You get the idea here that Daniel is not the main character of the story. The question of the story is this: in all of the broken pieces, how in the world will God's name be known and honored through all of these broken parts? And how can God possibly still be at work with these major broken pieces? That's the question. And God is at work in a surprising place and in a surprising way with the empire of Persia and with an 80-year-old-ish faithful servant in Daniel. There's an art form that I got acquainted with through a Japanese artist and theologian Makoto Fujimura. And the art form is called Kintsugi, and some of you are familiar with this art. Can I see your hands if you know what this is? All right, Sinkuji. Kin meaning gold, and sugi apparently meaning to mend with gold. And where this was used was in Japanese formal tea sets, bowls and cups, and sometimes passed down from generation to generation. And then there's an earthquake, and the whole thing comes down, and you're sitting in these pieces. What this art form does, Kintsugi does, is rather than hiding the fractures, it highlights the fractures. Instead of taking super glue and trying to make it look normal, they use gold and lacquer to bring out the full history of the bowl, including the broken places. Because trauma restored is new creation. And this is the art of the new bowl, with the fractures highlighted, becoming more beautiful and more valuable than the original item. What I'm saying here is this: invite God into the broken places. Invite God into the broken pieces. From the story of Daniel, where we see God at work in a surprising way and in a surprising place, believe that he is so creative and so artistic that he desires to use your whole story, including the broken, fractured places. When God restores, he creates art in the broken spaces. Invite him to do that in you today. I get to pray for you today before you go. Let me ask you to stand here at Cascade and in our other campuses and other spaces as well. And as is our practice, man, each weekend we have people that are at the front ready to pray with you and for you and over you. I just want to invite you, if something is being touched and moved and you don't quite know what to do with that, or if today catches you in one of those desperately broken spaces, take advantage of some of the people that are available here today to pray with you as the service ends. Gracious God, we give thanks that you are interested in using our entire stories. We give thanks for Daniel and his faithfulness and the faithfulness of his friends, and we ask that you would create that spirit of faithfulness in us. We ask this in the name of Jesus, who came on a mission of restoration. Amen. We'll see you next week.